The war in Yemen continues at a ferocious velocity. The Saudi-led coalition has bombed dozens of sites, killing tens of civilians. An apparent response to the attack by the Yemeni army deep inside the UAE. Yet the Saudi-led coalition denied carrying out an airstrike on a prison that killed at least 70 people, including migrants, women, and children. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the Saudi-led coalition hard-hitting bombing campaign is due to its failures on the battlefield and how vulnerable the UAE is when it comes to being targeted again. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have writer and political commentator Jim Kavanaugh joining us from New York. Also joining us is Yemeni activist and political commentator Hamza Shaiban, who joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome both of you gentlemen, and let me first start with you, if I may, Jim Kavanaugh. The Saudi-led bombing campaign, it has left dozens of civilians dead in one day as opposed to the preceding bombings, which have killed maybe on a smaller scale, but is still happening either daily, every other day, or on a weekly basis at a minimum. Don't you think that whether it's 70 in one day or a couple here and there every other day, it still requires the UN to address it?
I certainly do. This has been going on for 7 years now, since 2014, longer than World War II. And this is a vicious war. And it was said a couple of years ago, this is the biggest humanitarian catastrophe in the world. And my president, when he was running for president, Joe Biden, said he would stop giving offensive arms to Saudi Arabia over this. And of course, flip-flopped on that and pushed through an arms sale in December for Saudi Arabia. So, you know, this is a nasty war. The Saudis have the advantage of, you know, these modern fighter-bomber jet bomber planes. But the Houthis also have developed precision missile and drone capabilities that are worrisome and have hurt the Saudis and have this time hurt the UAE. And we shouldn't forget, at the beginning of this, when the Houthis came into the capital, they offered to have to let the ruling party join the government. And that was refused, and they ran off to Saudi Arabia and started this war. So you really have a nasty war that only continues with the good graces of the United States and Great Britain. The Security Council made a statement about the Houthi attack on UAE, but they didn't make a statement about the Saudi attack on a prison. What the heck are they doing there? And the UN Secretary General did. But, you know, they've kept their hands off of this because they don't want to tie Saudi Arabia's hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at what reaction the U.S. has had on this. Hamza Shaiban, the Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, he has said all parties to the conflict need to de-escalate and abide by their obligations under international humanitarian law, coming from the U.S. that provides arms to Saudi Arabia and the coalition. What's your reaction upon hearing that from the U.S. Secretary of State?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me speak today with you. Definitely, like, if the U.S. thinks that the parties in Yemen, represented by Ansarullah or the government in Sana'a, and the U.S. and UAE and Saudi coalition need to de-escalate this, then they definitely need to stop arming Saudi Arabia and UAE and providing them with arms so that the escalation actually takes place and, you know, the whole war stops. But when we see what's happening in Shabwa province and in Marib, what's happening is that UAE and Saudi Arabia continues to fund and arm the fighters who are fighting with them to continue taking more places. So, you know, if there are no practical actions taking place in ground, then definitely whatever the US or UK or UN says does not mean anything. There needs to be practical steps if the US is really serious about de-escalating the war in Yemen.
I'd like to refer an instance that happened just last week, Jim Kavanaugh, about Saudi Arabia and how it accused Iran of a false narrative that has been leveled against Iran time and again by Saudi Arabia. And it had to deal with this footage, which turned out to be from a documentary of a U.S., I guess, invasion of Iraq back in 2003. Accused Iran of being supportive or providing these ballistic missiles and besieged Red Sea port city of Hodeidah. You have Saudi Arabia coming out, making that accusation, and then coming out later and admitting to it being false. Spokesman of the Saudi-led military coalition in Yemen, Colonel Turki al-Maliki, admitting to this. So how do you take Saudi Arabia's word when it accuses Iran or for any other instances of it trying to lead down a narrative that's to its advantage?
Well, of course, you shouldn't take Saudi Arabia's word. I mean, the United States lied for 20 years about Afghanistan, and people knew it. They said it. They reported it a couple of years before the war ended. This was all a bunch of lies. So you shouldn't take it. You know, you shouldn't take anybody's word. You should take Iran's word. People should look at the evidence. They should see what's going on. And, you know, this is a war. People are going to get help from various sides. That's what happens. And the United States, nobody has any less right to support the Houthis than to support the factions that Saudi Arabia supports. So these kinds of, you know, silly, phony videos and proof that are offered all the time that turn out to be not proof at all, but just, you know, lies and fact-checking. But it's really all kinds of beside the point. We have to end this war. We have to, as your previous guest said, we have to de-escalate, we have to disarm, and we have to have pressure from the major governments in the world who are keeping this going to do that.
How is that going to happen, Hamza Shaybani, when the governments around the world, if we're talking about some of the Western ones like the UK, France, and the US, continue to provide arms and sell arms to Saudi Arabia and to the UAE and to the coalition, whatever's left of it? As a matter of fact, who is in this coalition that we keep talking about?
In 2015, when it started, Saudi Arabia said that there were 20 countries. But in reality right now, there are only two countries left that are in the front lines, Saudi Arabia and UAE. But they're also backed by Western governments like US, UK, even Canada, France, and a bunch of other countries. But these countries, they're benefiting economically from selling arms to Saudi Arabia and UAE. But they're also pushing them towards hell, because right now the war in Yemen is different. It's not like how when it started in 2015. Right now, the Yemeni military have the capabilities and the willingness and the ability to hurt Saudi Arabia and UAE, especially UAE. UAE is a fragile country. Their economy is very fragile. They cannot take or stand the ballistic missiles and the drones that the Yemeni army have promised to be sending very soon. A few other ballistic missiles or drones will definitely send a very strong signal to the investors in the UAE to leave the country, to the expats who are 90% of the population in UAE, almost 10 million people there in UAE are expats. When these people feel that UAE is not a safe place anymore, they will flee and leave UAE. So I really think that these Western governments, yes, they're benefiting economically from the war in Yemen, but they're also pushing UAE and Saudi Arabia towards hell, because right now it's different. Yemeni people can defend themselves, and they can also hurt these countries.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the UAE, if we can here, Jim Kavanaugh, where the latest coming from the Ansarullah of fighters in terms of a warning is that foreign companies need to leave the UAE. It's unsafe there, they have said. In a veiled threat of revenge attacks, we, quote, advise the foreign companies in Emirates to leave because they invest in an unsafe country, and the rulers of this country continue in their aggression against Yemen. So if I'm sitting there in some palace in the UAE, I would really think twice about this. So are they thinking twice and wanting not to get engaged, but they're being pushed to, maybe? Or what is the thinking behind them still engaged, even though they have said, if you want to look at the record, that 2 years ago they announced their official withdrawal?
Yeah, they withdrew their ground troops, and then recently, but what they do is they fund and support these militia, which are essentially jihadi militia. They don't want to put their own troops in there. As what your previous guest said previously is absolutely correct. This is a very dangerous situation for Saudi Arabia and UAE. These are fragile regimes, ultimately. And if they start getting hurt, and they were hurt, look at them. I think it was 2020 when the Houthis hit those Saudi oil facilities, and they were pinpoint hits. So there are now, and they cannot hold territory. They don't want to put their forces in there. That's why they rely on airstrikes. That's what they're going to do. They were losing the battles of Marib. The ground troops they're going to use are these militias that they're going to pay for, mercenaries, essentially. But, Saudi Arabia got into this MBS thinking this was going to be an easy win, and it'll pump up his image and the Saudi image in the region, and it's turned out to be exactly the opposite. And the longer this goes on, the more fragile those regimes are, the more likely those regimes are going to be hurt in serious ways.
There's another case here, the attack that took place on the UAE, Hamza Shaiban, that I'd like to ask you, and that is the way that Israel came out, apparently in a rescue attempt, where the Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, said, quote, "We stand ready to offer you, the UAE, security and intelligence support in order to help you protect your citizens from similar attacks," further saying that I've ordered the Israeli security establishment to provide the counterparts in the UAE with any assistance. Now, does this mean that Israel is thinking of either becoming more involved in this war or directly maybe involved in this war militarily?
I think there are, 2 points to address here. The first one is that I think Israel is trying to blackmail UAE, because we also, last year when there was a war between the Palestinians and Israel could not defend itself. They could not stop the missiles coming outside of Palestine, striking Israel. How can they save UAE right now from this war? And we all know that the capabilities of the Yemeni military is way more advanced than what they have in Palestine. This is the first thing. Second thing is that I think Israel is also worried right now, because the fact that the Yemeni army could target Abu Dhabi means that their missiles and their drones could also reach to Eilat port in the occupied land of Palestine. So this is also worrying for the Israelis as well. Now, Israel has been involved in this war in an indirect way, but it seems that their role in the coming days might be more direct and more obvious, which is also going to cause threat to themselves, because as Sayyid Abdulmalik al-Houthi has warned Israel 2 years ago that if they're getting involved in this war, then they should expect that Yemeni people would defend themselves, and they would target some strategic sites inside Israel.
Indeed, and there's another angle to why Israel may be interested, Matt, in this, Jim Kavanaugh, and that is, I'm going to refer to another statement here by the Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, in which he said, "Israel is committed to working closely with you, the UAE, in the ongoing battle against extremist forces, and we will continue to partner with you to defeat our common enemies. Now, who can Israel be referring to when it says that, other than Iran?
Nobody. It's that's what it's referring to. It's referring to Iran. They see a victory of the Houthis as a victory for Iran. Again, to the extent to which Iran is supportive of, in some way or another, of the Houthis, then that's going to be something that does benefit.
Well, you know what? I'm asking this question, Matt. I'm asking this question, Jim Kavanaugh. Sorry to jump in, is because I'm looking at the fact that Israel is going to play the UAE to try to come in through this window to get at Iran somehow, one way or another, trying to push the UAE, or maybe give ultimatums down the road. The UAE maybe not realizing this, because obviously Israel wants to get at Iran in any shape or form.
But it also works for the UAE and for the Gulf monarchies, who are also feel threatened by Iran. So really, they're trying to turn this into a multi-state alliance again against Iran, and any resistance forces in the region are going to be blamed on Iran. That's what's happening now, and it's the case that Iran is the country that gives the most support to these resistance forces, but they're independent forces. They're not controlled by Iran, and if they get some support, some kind, well, good for them, frankly, from my point of view. But Israel wants to pump up the Iran threat. Definitely, they want to use this to stop the JCPOA from being reinstated. They want to use it to maintain. They want to maintain their conservative Gulf monarchies also, and they're afraid of what would happen if there were problems. Look at what happened in Iran back in the day. The revolutionary Yemen back in the day. That would unleash forces of popular movements and resistance that the Israelis don't want to have appearing in the region.
Hamza Shehman, Iran has come out based on the most recent attacks that were heavy, causing a number of civilian casualties, saying that there's a lack of serious determination to advance the political settlements in that country, that obviously what's happening is going to lead to the destruction of the country and instability across the wider region. Why do you think there is a lack of determination for a political settlement?
I think Saudi Arabia and UAE know exactly that any political settlement is coming would mean that Ansarullah or the government of Sana'a right now would be part of it. And they will have the majority there because they are right now expanding in many areas. They are the most powerful Yemeni party right now in Yemen. So the dread of them is absolutely, not something attainable at this point. For them to, so that's why they tried to advance in Shabwa and Mar, because they thought that they can actually make them weaker and then go to for a political settlement. But this doesn't seem to be working for them very well in Yemen right now. And it's actually hurting them, because the longer they stay in this war, the more they could be hurt in their countries.
All right, let's look at within the U.S., Jim Kavanaugh, and what the Democrats have done just in the past 24 hours. They have said to Biden, you need to clarify the U.S. role in the conflict. And basically, the Congressman Peter DeFazio making this push. Jim Kavanaugh, are you with us? Wow. Okay, he's not with us. So, Hamza Shehban, my question goes to you. You have some Democrats, in this case, Peter DeFazio, who's a congressman there, saying that Washington needs to offer more, needs to clarify its stance. My question to you is, well, how much clearer can Washington be if Biden just approved over $600 million in sales to Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, see, the U.S. cannot hide from they can't cover their role in the war in Yemen. They're very complicit in this war, and they need to be held accountable. They're the main or the biggest arm exporter to Saudi Arabia and to UAE. I think UAE has a very apparent and obvious role in this war. And it's their war in Yemen right now. It's not, I don't think it's Saudi Arabia's or UAE's war in the region anymore. It's U.S. war, because if you think about it, yes, if U.S. really cares about Saudi Arabia and UAE and their stability and their safety, you know, they need to stop arming them and selling them weapons, because this is only getting back to them. This is only giving back to the U.S. with economic benefits. But down the road, these economies might be hurt, and hurt badly, to a point where they might not be able to defend themselves anymore. So I truly believe that, you know, U.S. And other Western governments, they don't really care about Saudi Arabia and UAE and their safety. But it's more for them, it's just a game where you know, they sell them weapons, they get money, but they don't really care about their future and their safety.
All right. Well, we do have Jim Kavanaugh back. Jim, I'd like to go back to September of 2021, where the U.S. came out with a stance on Saudi Arabia and removed these missile defense systems and Patriot batteries. It was announced back in September of 2021. Why did the U.S. do it or take this step at that point, when it's still obviously actively involved in one way or another for the security of Saudi Arabia?
I'm not sure, frankly. I think maybe because they weren't working very well. But that's a very good question. And I think also it had to do, well, I'm really not sure why they did that in September 2021, because as you say, they don't want to stop selling. For the United States, a lot of these wars are just excuses to keep selling arms. And the Patriot, taking out the Patriots, maybe that was Biden just giving a nod to his promises to, you know, withdraw military aid from Saudi Arabia. And he did something like that, and he thought it wasn't going to be terribly important anyway, because as we saw, those missiles didn't prevent the attack on the Saudi oil refineries. So other than that, I really can't tell you. But the United States seems to be, and I think they are, I disagree a little bit with the other guest here, I think they are concerned about Saudi Arabia. They don't want Saudi Arabia, they don't want these conservative monarchies to disappear and to be replaced by any kind of popular democratic revolution. They don't want that. Now, they're not as concerned about Saudi Arabia as they are about Israel, that's for sure. And they're not as concerned about Saudi Arabia maybe as they're concerned about selling a lot of weapons. But there's an important point for the United States in maintaining these conservative monarchies in place throughout the Arab world.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you. Jim Kavanaugh from New York, writer and political commentator. And Hamza Shaban, thank you. Yemeni activist and political commentator, who spoke to us from Toronto. Thank you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitale and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us. Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Darsi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
لهم فيها ما يشاءون خالدين كان على ربك وعدا مسؤولا
For them therein is whatever they wish, while abiding eternally. It is ever upon your Lord a promise worthy to be requested.
Brothers and sisters, in the previous program, we started talking about the 15th verse of the chapter. قُلْ أَذَلِكَ خَيْرٌ أَمْ جَنَّةُ الْخُلْدِ Say, is that better or the eternal garden, الَّتِي وَعِدَ الْمُتَّقُونَ which has been promised to the pious ones, كَانَتْ لَهُمْ جَزَاءً وَمَصِيرًا That shall be a reward and a resort for them. The 16th verse, however, says, لَهُمْ فِيهَا مَا يَشَاءُونَ For them, there will be therein whatever they desire. خَالِدِينَ They will dwell therein forever. كَانَ عَلَى رَبِّكَ وَعْدًا مَسْئُولًا It is for your Lord a promise that must be fulfilled. Let us have a quick look at this 16th verse, and then we'll go over some points regarding these two verses together. So at first, it is said, لَهُمْ فِيهَا مَا يَشَاءُونَ For them, there will be whatever they desire. So, you may remember in the previous program, we discussed the Almighty Allah being wise, and His demands are also wise. So, the demands of the people of the paradise are also logical and wise. And the Almighty Allah, at first it says, لَهُمْ فِيهَا مَا يَشَاءُونَ For them there will be whatever they desire, because their desire is merely based on the consent of the Almighty Allah. So, لَهُمْ فِيهَا مَا يَشَاءُونَ خَالِدِينَ They will dwell in the paradise forever, just like the people of hellfire, which will dwell in that fire, in that blazing fire forever, so are the people of paradise. Dwelling therein forever. And then, كَانَ عَلَى رَبِّكَ وَعْدًا مَسْئُولًا It is for your Lord a promise that must be fulfilled. This is the promised paradise that these believers will abide forever, خَالِدِينَ And this promise will definitely be fulfilled. Promises, promises. This paradise and the rewards therein were promised to the people in the world, and here their promise is fulfilled. Dear listeners, let us have a look at these two verses together. In the 15th verse, it is said, قُلْ أَذَلِكَ خَيْرٌ أَمْ جَنَّةُ الْخُلْدِ Say, is that better or the eternal garden? Then, in the 16th verse, it is said, لَهُمْ فِيهَا مَا يَشَاءُونَ خَالِدِينَ They are dwellers, dwellers forever. So, one time, it is said that paradise is perpetual as a quality. So, the word khuld has been mentioned. And one time, it is said that the people of paradise are perpetual. Khalidin.
Khalidin. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
It might be for stating this fact that both paradise and its inhabitants are everlasting. The Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, only Muslim will enter the paradise. Another point regarding these verses we discussed is that the sentence لَهُمْ فِيهَا مَا يَشَاءُونَ, for them there will be whatever they desire, is exactly the opposite point of what is said about the people of hell in chapter 7, which says وَحِيلَ بَيْنَهُمْ وَبَيْنَ مَا يَشْتَهُونَ, and a gulf is set between them and that which they desire. This is another consequence of wrongdoing in hereafter. The last point to be mentioned in this program, dear listeners, is about the word Masir. In the 15th verse, it was mentioned, كَانَتْ لَهُمْ جَزَاءً وَمَصِيرًا. That shall be a reward and a resort for them. This Quranic word Masir, which means the place of return, as you saw, is occurred after the word Jaza, or reward. This might be due to the fact that mentioning this word Masir after the word Jaza might be an emphasis to this fact that what is found in the concept of Jaza and reward and all of them, they are the opposite point of people of hell that have been mentioned in the previous verses. It was said about them, they are cast coupled in fetters into a narrow place of that fire. But now, the people of paradise, كانت لهم جزاء ومصيرا. That shall be a reward and a resort for them. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. Your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Why? And that's when faith begins.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Russia Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
There's no end in sight to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. Riyadh and its allies commit yet another inhumane crime amid the deafening silence of the United Nations and other international bodies and so-called advocates of human rights. Saudi warplanes bombarded the western city of Hodeidah and a detention center in the northern city of Saada within hours. Dozens of people, including children, were reportedly killed in Saada alone. The overnight strike on Hodeidah also left several casualties, most of them children. The strikes triggered a nationwide internet blackout in the country. The Norwegian ambassador to the United Nations, whose country holds the presidency of the UN Security Council for January, has reacted to the strikes.
New attack or series of attacks is at least 60 dead, maybe as many as 100. I mean, that can't be acceptable, can it?
No, I mean, it's not acceptable, and we absolutely call for restraints on all sides.
On Friday, thousands of Yemenis staged a rally in Sana'a to denounce the latest deadly airstrikes. The protesters condemned the United States for arming and backing Riyadh and its allies in the war on Yemen. The coalition has stepped up airstrikes against Yemen in recent weeks, killing dozens of civilians, including children.
Now we have become afraid day and night and in the morning. You don't know when the strikes will happen. The homes of citizens are now military targets, and this is what we fear. You fear that you will take children to school or to the hospitals or something like that, and you will get hit.
The spike in Saudi-led aggression follows Yemen's successful operation deep inside the UAE in retaliation for its role in the Saudi-led onslaught. During the operation, several sensitive locations in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, such as airports and oil refineries, were targeted with drones and ballistic missiles. Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the UAE, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 in an attempt to reinstate a friendly regime there. The kingdom has also maintained a blockade on Yemen ever since it began the war, while the impoverished country is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Years of bombing and blockade have left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions of them. The impoverished country is experiencing what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Twice a week, help is sent out by the truckload. Donations made to this charity in West London are on their way to families hit hard by the rising cost of living. For other charities, it's an everyday job. Nearly 2.5 million people used a food bank in the UK last year. With inflation now the highest in three decades, charities are warning it's only exacerbating an already dire situation.
The striking thing is how fast prices are rising. Bread up by more than 4%, margarine 27%, eggs more than 5%, and apples up by a fifth. The same with other staples. Put them all together, and you're talking about a sharp rise in the cost of living.
And that's just food. There have also been rises in the cost of transportation, clothing, and energy. Utility bills are expected to go up by 50% in spring, affecting some more than others.
You'll notice it, but it won't affect you too much. The poorest will be most affected by this. Those with the narrowest shoulders are taking the worst of the burden, which we need to reverse to try and make sure it's those with the broadest shoulders to take most of the weight.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect storm of COVID, Brexit, and global supply shortages.
The question now is whether the government's proposed ways of mitigating the pressure on the people are enough.
The good news is, so far, the capitalism has started to grow again. It's actually building back up. But they haven't addressed the issue of fairness, and over the next few months, this is going to be particularly painful in Britain. The cost of power, potentially doubling in the next few months, will mean that some people will go into fuel poverty, almost certainly.
These are just snapshots from across the country of a resurgence of poverty. And it looks like for many in the UK, things are going to get worse before they might get better. Saeed Purza, London.
Protesters outside the Israeli embassy have called for a boycott of Israel and those who support it, the delegitimization of the Zionist regime by Britain, which gave birth to it, and an end to apartheid.
We see you! We know your complicity! And we won't let you enable the ruthless and barbaric actions of the Israeli state in our name!
Israel is finding it more and more difficult to prevent the global community from knowing what's going on in the occupied territories. No amount of algorithms can stifle the cry for justice, and more people are standing in solidarity with the Palestinians.
For decades, Israel has been chipping away at Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Now it's set its sights on Sheikh Jarrah. In May 2021, this neighborhood became an international focal point, with residents resisting expulsion using digital activism. The diaspora was galvanized, 180,000 people took to London's streets, and the land grab was postponed as a result. Londoners say the videoing of atrocities is working, but the Israeli lobby is strong.
Mona Al-Kurd, who is from Sheikh Jarrah, as she was transmitting the demolition of the garden center of the Salha family, her Instagram was blocked. So as far as we can, the Palestinians and supporters try and portray to the world what is happening there. What we need to do is to find ways of turning that into a change in government policy.
The message is getting out. I'm of an age where I went first to Israel in the 60s, shortly after the Seven-Day War. People in this country did not know about Palestine. There was no understanding of the Nakba. There was no understanding of the expulsion of Palestinians. And for years and years, the Israeli government was allowed to continue, and this ignorance was perpetuated by the media.
Racism is a hot topic in the Western world, with people rising up against all forms of discrimination and inequality. And for many, Israel is synonymous with racism.
I think there are still organizations like the BBC which do not report what is going on in the ground. Therefore, tools like social media are really, really important.
They're not going to get away with it. And as Martin Luther King said, the arc of history may be long, but it bends towards justice. We will win this fight, because justice will win.
Demolitions have begun, some in the dead of night. Stun grenades were used, the power cut, and dozens arrested. The ethnic cleansing continues, as does the fight to end the last apartheid on Earth. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Russia's guided missile cruiser Varyag and its anti-submarine destroyer, the Admiral Tributes, paraded along Iranian and Chinese warships in Iran's southern territorial waters as the last phase of a joint naval maneuver, codenamed Maritime Security Belt, conducted over 17,000 square kilometer area in north of the Indian Ocean. The one-day drill engaged some of the latest naval equipment of the three participating countries.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy, together with the navies of the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China, staged a joint drill with the motto of Together for Peace and Security. The ultimate goal of the exercises is to enhance the readiness of the three countries in confronting marine threats that are posed to civilian seafaring.
China's Urumqi destroyer and Iran's domestically built Dena and Jamaran destroyers were among the vessels that were deployed to the drills. The trilateral maneuvers saw the three navies practicing anti-piracy operations, where they freed two commercial ships from pirates. Iran's Navy says the drill will significantly boost the three countries' coordination and synergy in combating piracy and ensuring the safety of international shipping in the strategic Indo-Pacific region.
North of the Indian Ocean is of a special significance in terms of global trade. That's why it is associated with constant threats such as terrorism and piracy. Therefore, closer cooperation between the actors in this region promises safer maritime trade for all countries.
North of the Indian Ocean hosts more than half of the world's maritime oil trade, which pass through three strategic straits of Hormuz, Bab el-Mandeb, and Malacca, together forming what's known as the Golden Triangle of International Trade. It's the third time Iran, China, and Russia are holding a joint drill in this body of water, with the aim to turn the thruway into a safe transit route for all passing ships. Iran, Russia, and China wrapped up their joint military exercises with strong messages. On top of them is their growing naval cooperation to ensure a collective security in the Persian Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and north of the Indian Ocean. This as they advised Western actors in the region to avoid destabilizing activities. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Iran warns that Israel is exploiting the United Nations mechanisms and other international bodies to cover up its daily crimes against Palestinians. In a statement, Iran's foreign ministry stressed the regime has always tried to use the victims of crimes in the Second World War to justify atrocities against Palestinians. The ministry said the regime has subjected Palestinians to all sorts of violations, especially crimes against humanity. It said that genocide, terror, and ethnic cleansing are just some of the crimes the regime is committing against Palestinians. The ministry further stressed Israel maintains the same racist and expansionist ideology that triggered crimes committed during the Second World War.
The eighth round of talks aimed at saving the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, between Iran and world powers, is steadily moving on. The Iranian delegation led by Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani has been in constant meetings with representatives of the three European signatories of the deal, Britain, France and Germany, EU coordinator Enrique Mora, as well as the Russians and the Chinese. Progress has been reported on talks concerning Iran's nuclear commitments, but there are still differences when it comes to the removal of US sanctions and the Iranian demands for verification and guarantees. Tehran says it wants assurances the US will not withdraw from the agreement again or reimpose sanctions. European and American diplomats have been voicing their concerns about the pace of the talks. An advisor to the Iranian team, Professor Mohammad Marandi, says the only reason progress is slow is because the Americans are resisting the notion that they have to give up sanctions.
I think the most important thing is that the Americans and the Europeans have still failed to remove sanctions or agree to remove many key sanctions. That is simply unacceptable for Iran. If the Iranians are going to put a cap on elements of its nuclear program, there has to be a change, of a clear change in the eyes of ordinary Iranians with regards to the sanctions regime. It has to be broken. Iranians have to feel that the Americans and the Europeans no longer have their hands on their throats.
Russian lead delegate Mikhail Ulyanov, who's been in frequent meetings with the American team led by Robert Malley, recently tweeted, "It's time to learn the lessons from the failed maximum pressure policy of the Trump administration." Iran says although there's been significant progress on technical matters, differences, including those in the area of sanctions lifting, require political decisions mainly by the Americans that, if made, can lead to a durable agreement within a short period of time. Omar Lizki, Vienna.
Is the British Home Office abusing its powers by denying a former Guantanamo Bay detainee his citizenship rights? That is the accusation being made by Cage's outreach director Moazzam Begg, who announced he's taking legal action in the hope of winning back his passport.
I've been arrested under terrorism laws three times, and I've had my passport taken away three times, all without any due process, all without any access to legal recourse, and all by governments of Britain, both Labour and Conservative, and yet I have not been convicted of any crime, I've never had my day in court, and I have actually been declared innocent by the very police that arrested me in the first place.
Moazzam is a British human rights defender who was made famous when he was detained and tortured by the US in Afghanistan's notorious Bagram prison and Guantanamo Bay between 2002 to 2005. Ever since his return to the UK, Mr. Begg's passport has been seized 3 times in just 8 years, the latest being in September 2021.
I gave evidence at war crimes tribunals. I have given evidence to the International Criminal Court for Britain and America's role in torture and abuse there. And I've looked at Britain and America's role in the rendition program with countries they claim not to have good relations with. And that, I believe, has been one of the key reasons why I have been targeted.
Begg has been accused of support for extremist groups in the past over his aid and investigative work in war zones such as Syria and Afghanistan, but was always found to be innocent. The Home Office has yet to publicly comment on this latest passport matter. This battle will be very significant, especially given the fact that Number 10 is currently trying to gift itself new powers to essentially remove people's citizenship at will with the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill. Many critics fear that the government just simply can't be trusted to wield powers like this fairly. Robert Carter, London.
It's been 1 year since U.S. President Joe Biden took office after defeating his contender Donald Trump in the 2020 presidential election. He took charge of the Oval Office with lots of promises, but let's look at where he's standing after 365 days. For one thing, Biden promised to bring the coronavirus pandemic in the country under control after Trump failed to do so. At the moment, the United States continues to be the world's worst hit country by COVID-19, with more than 68 million cases and over 858,000 deaths. Infections in the past weeks have been jumping, reaching an average of over 800,000 cases a day. This is while, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only 63% of the American population is fully vaccinated, and the numbers in southern states are much lower.
Look, folks, we're going to bring the Republicans and Democrats together and deliver economic relief for working families and schools and businesses.
These were Biden's words when he promised to get bipartisan cooperation to boost the U.S. economy and support the working class as, quote, the backbone of the society. Now we see that rift has not only widened between the two parties, but even the Democrats are divided over the issue, as some criticize Biden for not being bold or progressive enough with his agenda. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says Democrats are on the wrong path and need to make a major course correction, pivoting back toward the needs of working Americans. Sanders believes that in too many ways, the Democratic Party has turned its back on the working class. Turning to foreign policy, Biden said last February that the U.S. would step up diplomacy to end the war in Yemen.
We're also stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe.
But it looks like he couldn't keep that promise either. In December, the Senate supported Biden's $650 billion weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, even though Riyadh continues to target Yemeni civilians with airstrikes on an almost daily basis. Tensions between the United States and Russia have also escalated under Biden's presidency, especially more recently over Ukraine, with both Moscow and Washington targeting each other with tit-for-tat sanctions while warning against a complete rupture in their relations. And regarding the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5 plus one group of countries, Biden had this to say back in 2020, that his predecessor Trump had recklessly ditched the agreement, pledging that the U.S. would rejoin the deal under his presidency. But the Biden administration has been keeping the so-called maximum pressure campaign on Iran in place and has even imposed more sanctions against many entities and individuals, showing no serious intention in getting back into that agreement. The latest polls suggest that Biden is entering his second year in office with the worst job approval rating yet, a affected by the COVID chaos, the messy and deadly U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in late August. Biden's approval ratings started relatively strong at 57%, but by September they plunged to 43%. A new poll by Gallup and Morning Consult finds only 40% of U.S. adults currently approve of the job he is doing, his lowest to date. All in all, in the eyes of both Americans and the world, Biden has had a very disappointing record for his first year in office.
Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi made an official visit to Moscow on Wednesday at the invitation of his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. This is the first trip to Russia by an Iranian president since 2017. During a meeting in the Kremlin, the two sides set for talks on mutual and regional issues.
We have no limitation for expansion and development of ties with Russia and are after establishment of strategic relations with Moscow. We can expand our relations in economy, trade on the political track. We are not talking about momentary relations. We are talking about a sustainable and strategic relationship.
For his part, the Russian president said Iran-Russia's relations have been constantly improving. He also acknowledged Tehran and Moscow's contribution to Syria's transition past the terrorist threats.
Thanks to our efforts, we have largely succeeded in helping the Syrian government overcome the threats posed by international terrorism. Now, of course, both you and us are concerned about the situation that is developing in Afghanistan. I would like to discuss all these issues with you to know your position on these problems. And of course, it is very important for me to know your position on the JCPOA.
Iran's Raisi underlined that his country will never give in to the West's pressure, including the U.S., adding that Iran is seeking to remove the U.S. illegal and unilateral sanctions.
We have been confronting the U.S. for more than 40 years. We hope that these efforts would lead to removal of the sanctions. The threat of sanctions cannot come in the way of Iran's progress.
Ahead of the visit of Iran's Raisi to Moscow, Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdollahian said that his country followed a new roadmap to deepen ties with Moscow, adding that Iran and Russia were determined to update a 20-year cooperation treaty that they signed in 2001.
This is Iranian president's third foreign trip since taking office in July last year. The visit is seen by observers as the latest efforts by Iran and Russia to cement stronger ties amid U.S. hostile policies towards both countries. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
This is for a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Just as the human body becomes sick, so does the human mind. The sickness or the illness of one of them has an impact on the well-being of the other. If the mind is sick, the heart will also be sick, and the body will also be sick. And if the body is sick, the human mind will also suffer. You know, both of these two elements of the human existence are susceptible to outside influences. To put it differently, in the same manner that the body system becomes disturbed by various illnesses, the harmony of the thoughts becomes disturbed by different factors and evil traits. Man has the faculty of mind which cannot be independent of a person's conduct. The human conduct and behavior has an impact on the human happiness. Man can only feel happiness when he enjoys good manners that conform to his thinking. And it is the responsibility of man to eradicate the roots of the traits that hamper his comfort